Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast, a production of the Criminal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia. Every 2 weeks, we release a new episode. Today, we're going to have a conversation about a recent opinion from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Please note that these episodes may contain facts and circumstances surrounding criminal trials. Listener discretion is advised.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable United States Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Criminal Law Presents CAF Chats. My name is Major Dustin Morgan. I'm joined today by
Major Rianne Wentz.
Welcome back, Rianne. It's been a while since we've had you on.
I know. I'm fresh from ILE, so I'm really excited to be back here.
And talking the law instead of just pure military doctor.
Absolutely.
Today we're going to talk about CAF's latest case, or one of CAF's latest cases, United States versus Metz, which was argued in February of this year and decided on June 20th, 2024. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the facts in Metz?
Yeah, so I want to briefly talk about the procedural history, and then we'll talk about the facts. So Corporal Metz was convicted of one specification of arson, one specification of housebreaking, and one specification of unlawful entry. The decision from this summer that you just referenced is this case being in front of CAF for a second time. Initially, CAF set aside the NMCCA's decision and remanded the case to consider the three-pronged approach of Brown versus Illinois, regarding the effects of an unlawful apprehension on a subsequent search. The NMCCA affirmed the findings and sentence, and then it came to CAF a second time. And in the second appearance, Corporal Metz asked the court to decide two issues. One, whether he was a suspect when he was first interviewed by NCIS, which would trigger a requirement for 31 Bravo warnings. And two, did the lower court err in its application of Brown and its subsequent finding that his trial defense counsel were not ineffective when he failed to move to suppress evidence after an illegal apprehension? And note, not ineffective isn't the most effective way to say that, but it's the way we have to say it. Okay, so both of these issues are heavily fact-dependent, as are most Fourth and Fifth Amendment issues. So let's talk about the facts. In 2018, a fire broke out in a facilities maintenance building at Camp Pendleton, California. The responding firefighters found no signs of forced entry and suspected the fire had been intentionally set. The NCIS agents interviewed a supervisory NCO of the building, who told investigators that appellant and one other Marine had keys to the facility, but that the keys could be, quote, passed around. The NCIS agents asked about a helmet and a logbook that appeared to be intentionally burned. The NCO explained that these belonged to a sergeant who had recently counseled appellant. The NCO went on to say that Corporal Metz was, quote, a problem child with a bad grudge. And finally, the NCO said if anyone was going to start the fire, it would have been Corporal Metz. Now, I will say after I read all of this, I always try and guess when I read the facts sections of cases how I think it's going to turn out. And I will say this one was the opposite of what I guessed, but we'll get to that in just a second. Perhaps unsurprisingly, NCIS then went to interview Metz. They knocked on his barracks room door and explained that they were investigating, quote, an incident at his workplace. These words are in quotes in the NMCCA opinion, which indicates to me that the NCIS agents didn't say, we are investigating a fire at the maintenance building. Anyway, Metz let the NCIS agents into his room and said that he didn't know anything about the incident at the maintenance building. Metz claimed that he had lent his key to someone else. One of the NCIS agents noticed some shoes in the bathroom that appeared to be wet, and he asked Metz if he could look at them, and Metz agreed. As the agent got closer, he detected an overwhelming odor of gasoline, and the NCIS agent who detected the gasoline surreptitiously indicated to his partner that they should leave. Both agents then left appellant's room. At no point in this process did the NCIS agents read Metz his 31 Bravo warnings. So afterward, the NCIS agents waited outside of Metz's room to see if he would dispose of the shoes. After 20 minutes, the agents went back in the room, and the shoes had been moved, but Metz was not in the room, but then appeared to be coming back to his room from a breezeway. The NCIS agents asked Metz to take his hands out of his pockets, which, as we all know, is an egregious uniform violation anyway, but Metz was too slow to comply, which made the NCIS agent nervous. The agent said he didn't like Metz's behavior at that point, so he frisked Metz and placed him in handcuffs. Still handcuffed, the agents walked Metz back to his room. the NCIS agent removed the handcuffs and asked Metz for consent to search his room. Still no Article 31 Bravo warnings at this point. In the room, the agents didn't ask Metz any questions, but did see several items, including a bunch of stuff that smelled like gasoline. Then the agents drove Metz to NCIS for an interview. When they arrived, Metz signed an Article 31 Bravo rights waiver form. The following day, Metz signed another consent to search his room. So at this point, we have two consent to search requests signed by Metz. And NCIS at that point found the key to the maintenance building that Metz claimed he had lost. Metz was ultimately convicted of arson. So those are the many, many facts which lead us to kind of the two issues.
Right. And you really have a bunch of different things going on here. So you have the first interaction where there's some evidence that he's the one that's committed the arson here, but no real clear indication that it's him. Second one, after they've smelled fuel in his room, pretty clear indication he's the arsonist at that point, where they're, again, asking for consent to search at least, but no 31 Bravo invocation and no 31 Bravo rights given. And then you have him at NCIS being questioned. So important to keep that in mind as Rian goes through what the ultimate decision was and the law that the CAF cites here. So what happened?
So I want to break this down into the issue. So the first issue is about the 31 Bravo warnings. Now, we know that service members are entitled to both Miranda and 31 Bravo warnings. Miranda is triggered by custody and interrogation. Now, we aren't worried about Miranda here. We're only worried about 31 Bravo. But when we're talking about rights warnings, I like to emphasize the point that service members are entitled to both. But to the point, Article 31 Bravo warnings are required when four things are present. One, a person subject to the UCMJ. Two, interrogates or requests any statement. Three, from an accused or person suspected of an offense. And four, the statements regard the offense of which the person questioned is accused or suspected. Now, we're really focused on the third prong of this trigger in this case, whether a person is suspected of an offense. And that is a totality of the circumstances analysis. Whether the military questioner believed or reasonably should have believed that the service member committed an offense. Now, through case law, we don't really have a bright line rule here. We do know that to suspect someone for purposes of Article 31 Bravo, it requires a low quantum of evidence, but needs to be more than a hunch. And I use that word specifically because hunch is the word that they use in the case law. And they use it here, and they use it in the case that they cite. Here, CAF held that the trial judge's ruling that Metz wasn't a suspect when NCIS first talked to him is not clearly erroneous. Now, to your point, this what we're talking about, remember, is when they first knock on the door and they first go in the room. The NMCCA classified Metz as, quote, a person of interest rather than a suspect. And the NCIS themselves indicated that they were merely conducting screening interviews. And it wasn't until the agent smelled the gasoline on the shoes that the investigation really shifted to focus on Metz.
Yeah, at this point, what you have several things, right? Two people have the key. He's one of them, potentially. Mm-hmm. He's got a bone to pick with one of the NCOs whose helmet and logbook seems to have been burnt. And he's a, quote, problem child. So, I mean, okay, it can cut either way, right?
Yeah, and there is a note in the CAF opinion, I think, that talks about how the NCO at some point was a person of interest, was kind of a... He was so interested in the fire.
Yeah.
And so, you know, also you have to consider where the information is coming from. But yeah, to your point, there's all of, like, there's a lot of innocent explanations for all of those things as well. But CAF held that both the objective facts and circumstances and the subjective belief of the NCIS agents led them to conclude that the 31 Bravo rights were not required, warnings were not required here.
Right. And they're really looking at the military judge's decision here, right? Because they ultimately file this motion with the judge, look for it to be suppressed. And the judge says that the questioning and the derivative evidence that comes from it are good to go. And I think that's kind of an important distinction, because even if you look at that and be like, well, what other conclusion is there but that he's a suspect, reasonable, given the three things taken together. Ultimately, you have to be able to point back to the judge's decision and be like, well, he or she was wrong about this in particular, and they can't do that in this instance, it appears.
And it has to be really wrong, right? Like, clearly erroneous.
Really.
When you're looking at the deference that CAF is going to give that trial judge because they filed the motion, I mean, the military judge here would have had to have been really, really wrong, to your point.
It's what James is always railing against you and I against for having worked on government appellate and overcoming that defense appellate. So
yeah, it is very difficult to overcome. Makes it a lot easier on the government appellate
for
side.
Sure.
So the second issue. So the second issue is framed as IAC, and the issue is whether or not Metz's counsel were ineffective for failing to move to suppress the evidence derived from an illegal apprehension. Now, we talked about IAC in the context of motion during our Pallet podcast, but as a refresher, the appellant must show that the counsel's performance was deficient and that that deficient performance resulted in prejudice. The review by appellate courts is highly deferential in this in IAC cases. And when we're talking about motions, the appellant has to show that there was a reasonable probability that the motion would have been meritorious. So they have to show that there was a reasonable probability that they would have won this motion. But that's how we get to sort of the substance of the question here, whether the evidence derived from Metz's illegal apprehension should have been suppressed. You know, I keep saying illegal apprehension because both the NMCCA and CAF both find that Metz's arrest was illegal. Maybe NCIS had enough for a Terry stop because the NCIS agent talked about that he was nervous and all of those things, but there was no PC to arrest Metz, and he should not have been handcuffed and walked all the way back to his room.
Yeah, and if you remember back to law school, for those of you that went, that listen, Terry involves like officer safety type concerns. So the hands in the pocket, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe he has a weapon, I mean, but ultimately he's an arsonist and not like a violent criminal. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. And I think they say, you know, maybe they had enough for a Terry stop, and like the NCIS agent could have stopped him and frisked him and all those kinds of things. But really there was nothing other than him having his hands in his pockets that was articulated in the NMCCA opinion or the CAF opinion that indicated there was an officer safety issue. Okay, so the question then was whether Metz's consent to search his room was sufficiently an act of free will to purge the primary taint of the unlawful act. So the unlawful act in this case is that illegal apprehension. And so then the question becomes, was his consent to search his room an act of free will? And the question is, was it attenuated enough? We talk about the attenuation doctrine. So was it sufficiently free of that taint, right? They use the Brown factors to determine whether or not Metz's consent was an independent act of free will. And the three factors in Brown are the temporal proximity of the illegal conduct and the consent, the presence of intervening circumstances, and three, the purpose and flagrancy of the initial misconduct. CAF held that the first factor favored appellant. The request for consent to search took place minutes after the illegal apprehension. And the second factor weighed in favor of the government in that there was no real causal connection between the illegal apprehension and the consent to search. And then finally, the third factor, which CAF said went in favor of the government and was dispositive here, speaks to the purpose behind the exclusionary rule. Remember, the exclusionary rule is a judicially created remedy that is intended to deter problematic police behavior. CAF found that nothing in the NCIS's agent's behavior or testimony indicates sort of the level of flagrancy or purpose and intent needed to trigger the exclusionary rule. Basically, there was no indication that the NCIS agents were purposefully or willfully or maliciously trying to contravene the Fourth Amendment, right? Like, they weren't trying to engage in behavior that would violate the Fifth Amendment in an effort to obtain this evidence. And so there would be no reason to punish them, because the exclusionary rule at its heart is a punishment to deter this police misconduct. And in a lot of these Fourth and Fifth Amendment cases, courts are doing sort of this balancing act between deterring police behavior and excluding evidence, which can be a really drastic remedy in a lot of cases. And ultimately, CAF concluded that Metz didn't carry his burden regarding the IAC claim.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they're framing it under this like mode of review instead of whether or not, again, it's abuse of discretion, because the motion wasn't filed at the mm-hmm. trial level, which may be our practice point to take away from this. You have to mm-hmm. look out for stuff like this. Okay, what else of note on this opinion?
Of note, I just want to make a note of Chief Judge Olson, who wasn't buying that Metz wasn't a suspect, and I have to say I tend to agree. He notes that the NCIS agents knew that appellant had been identified by his sergeant as the likely culprit, and they knew that appellant had the means, motive, and seeming proclivity to commit an act of this nature. So I just wanted to make a note of Chief Judge Olson's dissent and that he thinks that Metz was probably a suspect.
But again, abuse of discretion.
Abuse of discretion.
And if you look back, I mean, the judge developed a pretty good record here. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to overcome that at the appellate level, especially if you disagree, which CAF doesn't say whether or not they disagree, but they've said time and time again, even if they do, we're not reversing, absent, you know, clearly erroneous findings of facts or misapplication of the law. And the judge nailed both of those here, it looks like.
Yeah. And developing a good record is a great segue into some of the takeaways, I think, for this case. And the number one takeaway I have for this case and cases like this, facts matter so much in these cases because so much of the case law in the Fourth and Fifth Amendment require a totality of the circumstances analysis. And what do you consider in the totality of the circumstances? The facts, the facts. So when you file your motions, when counsel file their motions, they should be incredibly detailed. But remember, your pleadings are not evidence, right? And so you should have a detailed timeline. You should have a detailed articulation of your facts. And then you have to have the evidence to back it up. That wasn't necessarily an issue in this case, but there was an incredibly detailed record developed because, you know, they had all of this evidence. They had sort of this, they had all of these facts.
Yeah, I think the government probably like did a really good job here because basically the way I viewed these like illegal search and seizure and illegal questioning type cases is it's a prove it card to the government.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm alleging that this bad thing happened. Now prove that it was okay.
Yep.
And they seemed to call the NCIS agents and laid a pretty adequate foundation to be like, oh, we were doing the right thing here. So good job by the government in this instance on that.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily good faith, but sometimes it feels a little bit like a good faith analysis. Like, were they trying to do the right thing?
Sure.
Were they trying to, like, make the right moves? Were they? And you know, one of the things was that once they smelled gasoline, they stopped and removed themselves from the situation and thought, okay, what do we need to do next kind of thing. But yeah, so developing the record and developing the facts. Two is understanding the timeline. So this area of the law is incredibly nuanced and has these sort of overlapping layers with Miranda and other issues. And so counsel on both sides have to have a clear understanding of what happened and when it happened, because there can be different triggers at different points. So you have to understand, you know, for example, that the request for consent to search after the illegal apprehension is going to be a different analysis, right, than the 31 Bravo analysis. And all of these things are happening within a short window of time. But counsel just have to understand, and my best recommendation is to have that detailed timeline, because that's the way that you're going to help sift through all of the facts that are required here.
Yeah, this is really complicated. So good luck, I guess, is our best advice to you on these issues.
Organization can help your luck, I think. But then the last thing is, as with Palak, file the motion. And again, I know that me sitting here being like, you should write another motion, file it. You have time to do that. I know nobody has time to do that, but filing the motion makes sure that you preserve the issue. And then also, it makes you less likely to be open up to IAC claims.
Which is an uncomfortable feeling, having gone through it once personally.
Yep.
Uncomfortable feeling.
Yeah. Well, and just so our listeners know, I defended Major Morgan. I did at the appellate level. I defended his fantastic decisions as a defense counsel. And so now here we both are. Sometimes I regret my excellent advocacy,
yes.
But
I was found very effective, by the way, just so listeners are super clear on that.
Very effective is not a legal standard or a legal determination. But that's all I've got. I mean, this is just a case that really sort of evaluates this case for me, the takeaway is, what does it mean to suspect someone under 31 Bravo? Because that is mushy, for lack of a better descriptor. Like, there is just not a clear bright line, and this kind of gives us some guidance on that. But
yeah, those totality of circumstances ones are always, you can never guess what's going to come out. Like you said, you read this originally and like, oh, I know this is going to go, and it turns out a different way.
Yep.
Okay, well, thanks again to all our listeners out there. We appreciate you as always. Please subscribe, like, and review us. And until next time.
Thanks for joining us today for another episode of the Criminal Law Department Presents podcast. If anything you heard sparked a thought, we'd love to connect with you. Your comments help us create better future content for the field or the fleet. Reach out to us on Facebook or Instagram. The information can be found in the show notes for today's episode. The views expressed in today's podcast are those of the presenters and not necessarily the Judge Advocate General's or the Department of the Army or the Department of Defense.
Thanks, counsel, for both sides. The court will stand in recess until further order of the court.